it on the inside. Let's go, let's take it where your friends might not know. Yes, take them to the riverside. I know you've been waiting for me. Get the keys and just grab the Henny. Leave your friends, girl, you got too many.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Dropping Wisdom with Santos podcast. And before I get into today's guest, I want to thank everybody for all the listeners, all the people that subscribed, all the followers, and all my guests that listened to this podcast and that were on this podcast for this year. Not sure how many episodes I want to do for the rest of this year, so I want to give a quick shout out to everyone, and I want to go down the line here. Shout out to my buddy Vision One, which actually gave me the music for my intro. Shout out to my buddy Emilio Bullard and his wife Nikita. Their restaurant, The Green Gambit, was ranked one of the top best restaurants in Freeport, the Bahamas. My buddy Black Jesus, Jesus Encarnacion, the store manager of Oceana Nutrition Corner, is no longer the store manager. He's the district manager now. Let me keep going down the line here. My buddy Ray Gatlin, the school administrator and high school football coach. He was on the episode saying how he never won a state championship a couple weeks after he was on the podcast. Oscar Smith won the state championship, so that was great for him. And you see who else we got. My buddy, my buddies, Boston Mike and Kenny on the episode of the dealership's mistreatment of their mechanics. Congratulations to them for opening up their own garage, Two Vets Garage. Kudos to those homies. Sarah Marie, the professional makeup artist, opened up her own studio, Sweet Face Studio. That's another good one. Let's see here. Carrie Ressler now works for a different private school, which now she works for the private school that I'm a parish of, the Star of the Seas, which is awesome. My mom donated a statue there, a St. Joseph statue there in front of the columbarium of the church. So that's awesome. Wow. Now she works there now because I'm from, you know, that's a great church. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Jocelyn Flores, the virtual assistant. Ever since she's been on my podcast, her clients that she has doubled. So that's great for her business. And the Egg Bistro for Mike and Doug. Currently, a couple weeks ago or so, two people were able to do their food challenge, that 4-pounder. I couldn't do it, and I'm not one of them. I tried it. There was just too much corned beef and sauerkraut in that omelet for me to handle that. I couldn't do it. Could not do it. Jenny Telfer, the professional bikini bodybuilder and posing coach. 2 weeks ago, she won her division of the swimsuit division. She got first place in that. And last but not least, me. Because of the fantasy football episode that I had that people were giving me shit about, that I was didn't know what I was talking about. I'm in 3 fantasy football leagues. I'm in 3 playoffs. My co-host of that episode was Ryan Ross. He's not in the playoffs. So there's that. All right. And I want to thank my buddy, which is today's episode, the 911 Phone Call Killers Part 2. David Newman's on. And I want to thank him for being a reoccurring guest. And part one of the 911 Phone Call Killers got great reviews. Everyone thought it was bananas.
Good.
And so that's today's episode with David Newman, 911 Phone Call Killers Part 2, because everyone was like, holy shit. Because a lot of people didn't know you could, they learned off that because they didn't know they could text 911.
Yes.
So that was a real eye-opener for them too.
Yep.
So go ahead, buddy. Let's go.
Do what okay, you gotta do. Yeah. We'll pick up the where we left off last time with phone calls. And again, just as far as how we use a 911 phone call in death investigations, there's two areas that we do that at my level, being a homicide detective, as part of our SOP that we always listen to our 911 phone calls with any unattended death. So it could be a infant death, which are critical, suicides, equivocal deaths, and obviously murders. And so we listen to the phone call to evaluate, not analyze, but what is the focus of the caller and is it where it ought to be? And, you know, initially during that active phase, we consider everything. We don't rule anything out. So once we get past the active phase with 911 phone calls, we go into what's called the ongoing phase. And that's where you actually have evidence analyzed by the lab phone calls analyzed by experts like Tracy Harpster. I mentioned him last time. And then we can build a case and draw conclusions from that analysis. And then ultimately, hopefully, build a case against a suspect once everything else has been ruled out. So what we have today are a couple of cases where the caller ended up being the killer. One of the cases, the one I'll play first, was what we call equivocal death. And that is where initially during the active phase and maybe early ongoing that the manner of death is open to interpretation. So you might think what you see is a homicide or suicide, maybe suicide or accidental. So ultimately what's going to determine what it is your victimology, the medical autopsy, and as well as indicators within the scene that we're going to look at to kind of put it one towards one manner over another. But everything starts out by listening to this phone call. So the first one I'm going to play for you is out of Arizona. This is a guy who called, and I'll advance this a little bit, about his wife. And I'll let the phone call play through and let you understand what I thought was wrong here about what he was saying. But he calls 911 to report his wife having killed herself. His wife had no health issues. She was deaf, but she had no stressors as far as victimology goes. But during the phone call, what you'll see he does is he doesn't focus on her survival at all. He accepts the fact that she's dead. He's very scene descriptive, tries to, you know, explain what happened. And this guy never initially did cooperate with the investigation. So when I heard the phone call, and where she shot herself as well was kind of unusual for a female to do that. And he also described, I don't see a gun, but now I do see a gun. But they were able to go back with that investigation, convince this guy to take a polygraph, which he failed, and then ultimately confessed to killing his wife. So here's a guy calling to mislead and lie when ultimately he was the killer. So I'll go ahead and start this and advance it to about 1 minute into the phone call. Our dispatcher's talking. So let me advance that to the point we want to be. And then here we go. Oh, let me get this going here again. Let me open this with one more.
What year was this?
This was about 5 years ago when this happened. And I can open this.
You know what part of Arizona?
It was near Tucson.
I'm not surprised, man. I met some people in Arizona. A bunch of weirdos.
This guy was no doubt odd. But this was the dispatchers ending their conversation and the caller taking over. Dispatcher here did a very good job, in which we rely on. They had to call him back.
Hi, sir. This is the fire department. What's your address?
1731 East Sierra Libra.
And your phone number? I've got. What's going on?
My wife, I think, committed suicide.
What's going on with her? Is she awake?
No, she's laying on the ground stiff.
She's stiff? Can you get her flat on her back?
She's stiff, ma'am.
He's polite.
How long ago was the last time that you saw her?
This morning.
How old is she?
She's 52.
Do you want to try and do CPR, sir? I can walk you through it.
Ma'am, she is stiff.
Okay, I'm asking you, do you not want to do CPR at this point? We can try CPR or not.
Hesitation, there's the key.
Oh, my God! Please hurry, just send somebody.
They're on their way, sir. You're not going to do CPR with me?
Ma'am, she's stiff. I can't.
Okay. What time this morning did you last see her?
At 7 o'clock this morning.
Does she have any medical conditions we need to be aware of?
Do I?
No, does she?
She's blind.
She's blind.
Is there any pill bottle or anything around?
No, but there's a pistol out here.
Okay, hold on the line for me.
How'd she find the pistol?
She's blind. That's one thing, but the pistol's nowhere near her body. And he claims he didn't touch anything.
Because normally what you do when you blow your head off, you throw the gun afterwards.
Yeah. But there's no right...
She's already comatose. She's in rigor mortis. What do you call that?
She was not. Yeah, rigor.
Yeah.
She was not when they got there.
So she wasn't stiff.
Oh, man.
No. So, and you see with this call... without any focus on survival, and that's instinctual. If you have a relative, you know, you go home and God forbid find your spouse or child or sibling on the ground, and unless there are obviously signs of death there, you're not going to accept that death because people go into denial. And he didn't do that. So he accepts the fact she was dead, didn't focus on survival. He was polite, and he hesitates when asked certain questions. But that was enough of an indicator or red flag to go back and reapproach this guy to take a polygraph, which he bombed the polygraph. And then he ultimately did confess to what he did. So that's the thing about, you know, that's not even analyzing the phone call. That was simply the evaluation. But what Tracy Harbister does is he can actually listen to that phone call and come up with a plan or strategy to go back and reapproach someone, reinterview them using their deceptive indicators. He picks up and then hold the strategy.
Okay, now Tracy's the detective.
Tracy is retired from the Moraine PD in Ohio. And Tracy was the one who actually initiates a study of phone calls with the FBI. And so Tracy's is the expert in the country as far as actually analyzing these phone calls and then coming up with investigative strategies to go back and reapproach someone. But Tracy's very good because he's done so much work and research at picking out the smallest deceptive indicator and knowing what it means.
Okay. What did he pick up at this phone call?
Well, he didn't listen to that one. I did. Now, we listen to that from the evaluation perspective. So when I listen to a phone call, if you get called in, like say you're home and you're called into work at 3 a.m. because you got, a death that appears to be suicide, but you're not sure, first thing I do is listen to the phone call. That's in first and foremost. So no one's going to do that but the investigator. So you have to train yourself to recognize what innocent people tend to focus on versus those who are guilty. And you start to see a pattern of behavior form. But that's not analyzing. That's just simply, okay, I'm painting a picture in front of me what I think this is.
I would think that if my wife was shot, I wouldn't need a 911 dispatcher to tell me to do CPR.
You wouldn't, yeah, and most of the time you wouldn't have to.
How long does it take for the body to hit rigor mortis?
It depends on the size of the victim, the environment they're in, the service they're on, and actually, you know, gauging someone's time of their death, rigor mortis is the worst way to do that. Because, you know, if someone's larger or smaller, they lack muscle mass, because what rigor is simply chemical changes in the muscle after death to form these locking bridges. And once decomposition sets in, rigor mortis goes away. But the best way to actually establish someone's time of death is what's called ALGR mortis, and that's simply body temperature. So there is a formula that we use to identify and determine body temperature by a liver stick. The Emmys will come out and usually do that, but you have lividity. But really the best way to establish someone's time of death is try to identify, okay, when was your last activity in that scene?
All right. Scientifically, through the lab, how long does it take to figure that out?
They can figure that out within minutes.
Okay.
I mean, if the body temperature being taken, we can narrow it down. But really, medical, and that falls under medical legal death, that's the last thing that we fall back on. The first thing I look at are scene markers, electronic devices like cell phone activity, witness statements like neighbors, and then changes in the body which are visible. And you could pretty much narrow down a nice workable window from doing that when they died.
Okay. Now, how far was the gun away from her?
It was in the cabinet. That's the thing.
And it was in the cabinet?
It was in the cabinet.
But she shot herself in the head?
Yes. It was a headshot away from, allegedly.
Okay.
And that's the thing about women. Not that they don't do that, but most women who self-inflict with the gun do so on the chest. But because they shoot themselves in the head doesn't rule out suicide because there's the exceptions to the rule, obviously. But the big driving factor, I think, there, I thought, was victimology. Because most suicide victims, you can identify a stressor in their life that caused them to become depressed and then do what they did. And I've never worked a suicide in my career where we couldn't identify a stressor. In that case, they could not identify one.
Okay, now you're saying that a higher percentage of women that commit suicide mainly shoot themselves in the chest and not the face.
Well, no, most women don't shoot themselves. But if they do, it's in the chest versus the head or face. Because you look at suicide by firearm, that accounts for 51% of all suicides. And most of them are men. So women tend to use less violent methods. They'll either overdose, self-asphyxiate.
Pills, pill pop.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, What, in your, is their opinion of why they shoot themselves in the chest and not the face, though? And that, what, why is that?
I'm not sure if it's either actually vanity to a degree, because most women will not mess up their face or any sexual parts of their body.
They want to look pretty for an open casket or some shit?
I don't know. But it
is, you know what I'm saying?
I think it's just gender. It's one of those gender traits.
Okay,
that we
now,
see.
When the cops and the ambulance came to the scene, of this scene, I don't know if you know, but if they were told that she was stiff, but looked at her and noticed that she was limp.
Well, there's no doubt that drew suspicion.
Yeah, and technically they didn't see the gun because the gun was in the cabinet, so who shot her?
Well, he said, you've heard that his statement, he said, there's a gun out here. But then he said the gun's over in the cabinet. So he changed the story a little bit during the phone call.
Ugh.
So you see people, you know, what drives, I think I mentioned this last time we talked about this, and Tracy.
I could have solved this case, bro.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's amazing. Now, a lot of times, what first responders in some small departments don't do right. Like, for example, I was just in Youngstown, Ohio this past week doing a three-day class with Youngstown in Pittsburgh. And they had a case they got called into, in fact, on Monday. And they had a guy who had been shot. They don't think it was a suicide now, but before the state PD got there, the local department had the body taken from the scene, didn't take any photographs, collected the evidence. So it's going to be very hard to prove right now without that scene being documented properly, you know, what they can and cannot do. But that's why scene management is so important.
I got it. So lots of times the cases, a murder case can be solved easier and quicker if the on-scene people
absolutely
do their job correctly.
Assessment is the first stage in the of the active phase. That's the most critical part because it's what officers do or don't do that makes the evaluation and the ongoing phase easier or more difficult. And some of the best investigations, I don't say best, but the most successful that I've worked were the first officers and first responders did their job perfectly. And they got a big challenge, you know, because every scene's different. Every victim's different. You might look at, you know, one scene and think it looks like one thing, but yet it ends up being something else. So you got to be very objective when you approach a death investigation.
Okay. What's the next one?
This one. Now, this one is one of the more brutal murders. And this involved an old guy named Grant Bogstad. And it's out in Ocean View, like near 13th Bay, which is not the greatest area, you know, back in the day. But Grant Bogstad was in his 70s. He lived alone. He had no family. Well, the suspect, Penny Gurley, in this case, she's a prostitute. Well, he lets her move in because she had nowhere to stay. She was homeless, but she didn't go out and turn tricks. And she being friends over the party in his house, he thought she was stealing from him. So one evening he told Penny, listen, you got two more nights and you got to get out of my house. I don't want you here anymore. But she had nowhere to go. And she was taken from Social Security, I think, money from him. So the last night she's allowed to be there, she had a friend Crystal over, which we didn't find out until later. And she told Crystal, they were high, they'd been smoking crack and everything. They were making a big vat of fried chicken, like a big fry daddy. So Penny told Crystal what
crack
was going on.
Crack and fried chicken, boy.
Yeah, it works, yeah. I guess you get the munchies. But she told Crystal, hey, you know, Grant's kicking me out and I'm pissed off about it. And Crystal said, well, what are you going to do? And Penny said, watch this. She unplugged the fryer, had over a gallon and a half of boiled grease, walked back in Grant's bedroom and poured the grease over his head. So she fried the old guy in bed. He died of a heart attack and also the traumatic, you know, being burned. So then Crystal sees this and got scared and ran. Penny goes outside and threatens her and says, if you tell the police what I did, I will kill you. And Penny has brothers called the Arnie brothers. They're a known criminal element in Norfolk area. So what happens is Penny calls 911. So I'll play the call. And first of all, she tells first responders that when they got there, she said, listen, it was Penny's birthday. I was drinking. I fell asleep outside in the porch for like 4 hours. And I woke up because Grant was screaming, but I didn't see anyone. Well, that time of year on the bay, it was cold as shit outside. She had on sweatpants and a t-shirt and wasn't cold at all. But then she tells the dispatcher, as you're hearing, something completely different. So Penny's going to minimize and say, okay, I wasn't home and somebody burned my friend really bad. I think it was meant for me, but they went after him. Grant was dead in his bed. But she tried to make it sound like he was up and walking around. He never did.
I mean, how the hell are you going to say, hey, he committed suicide by pouring grease on his face?
It wasn't suicide. Now, this one, she said he was murdered, but by somebody else.
Okay.
So when we got there, we had Penny in the police car.
She's was he on crack too? Shit.
Oh, no. Just an old, lonely guy.
Okay.
You know, looking for some companionship.
Yeah,
and Penny was in the back of a patrol car, and I talked to her. She's drunk as shit. And I said, okay, Penny, what happened? She goes, well, I was outside asleep, and I heard Grant scream, didn't see anyone, and I went inside, and somebody poured grease all over his head. So that's all we had to do. And initially, we couldn't charge her with anything at that time because there's not enough evidence that she did anything. So just developing, you know, information through informants, we got to Crystal. And we arrested Crystal on a prostitution charge, and she agreed to testify against Penny and cooperate. And that kind of fell through a trial, explained what happened at trial. But Penny, after threatening Crystal, she calls 911. And this is Penny's phone call.
Companionship with a crackhead.
Oh, yeah.
That's classy.
Yes, she was not.
Okay, is this a house or an apartment?
A house.
All right, you make sure the front door's unlocked.
Yes, ma'am.
Put away any family pets, and we'll get somebody over there, okay?
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Now, a couple of things about that call. She's polite. And those who are polite doesn't mean they're guilty, but guilty people tend to be polite. They use terms of respect, tend to be patient. But you notice right away, you know, I don't know. She denies knowledge, which is a big red flag, too. I wasn't home. But then she changed the story to I was home, but outside. So what happened here, we're able to finally get warrant. We actually indicted Penny Grody for murdering Grant out of just the motivation was just being vindictive. And when it came time to go to trial, we had Crystal on the stand. And that's our only, that's our case in chief, is Crystal. And Penny's brothers, the Arnie brothers, are in the courtroom, and they're intimidating Crystal on the stand. So on the stand, in front of the jury, Crystal redacts and retracts her statement and said, okay, I'm sorry, I lied. I wasn't there. I didn't see anything. So all of a sudden, her whole case came crumbling down right there in court. So we had to call a timeout, and we pulled Crystal aside, and she refused to testify out of fear of being killed by the Arnies. So we did have enough circumstantial evidence there where Penny pled guilty to a lesser charge, basically an Alford plea, which says, okay, I'll plead guilty, but I'm innocent. And a judge sentenced her to like 10 years in prison. So she got nowhere near what she should have gotten. But, you know, you can't always rely. And cases built on direct evidence are very, very challenging cases because it's credibility and reliability issues that we see a lot in direct evidence, which is testimonial.
Hmm.
But yeah, that poor guy and his kids they lived in Maryland. He had some family up there, but they weren't that close. But yeah, she simply killed the old guy because he was kicking her out of her house, his house.
Well, that's so what brutal. Happens when you need
mess with the wrong people. I'll tell you what,
mess
you're
with
the wrong
no
person move in. Do you have time to do another one?
Yeah, let's do one more.
Okay, we'll do one more. And this one I mentioned last time. I want to get to this one because I couldn't find it last time. This is out in Marietta, California, and this was a murder of, let me see, I know Kelly Zarga is a suspect.
How long ago?
Oh, this has been probably 8 years or so, and it's right the first one. Oh, here we go, Zarga. Now, Isabella is the victim here. Kelly Zarga, the husband, is a suspect, and this one was one of those types of cases where it looked domestic, but you had no weapon, no witness, no smoking gun, because it occurred in the home. And those are always challenging investigations. So it took Marietta, California, the PD, about six weeks to build a case enough to indict Kelly Jarka. The motive for killing his wife was because of money. He was about to be caught having a lot of affairs. He burned a lot of credit cards on prostitutes. And Isabel would have kicked him out of the house. That would have been it. So he killed her over greed. He staged a brutal scene to make it look like an intruder did it, which an intruder did not. But the main thing here with Kelly is watch what he doesn't focus on. Now, he calls 911, but watch how long it takes Kelly to actually acknowledge his wife. And he claims he went to get her some coffee and took the twins to her parents' house. They have a six-month-old in their house. And when he came back from getting Kelly or Isabella coffee, then she'd been brutally, you know, killed by an intruder. So he staged a crime scene, and that's the second most commonly staged scene that we have. But just pay attention how long it takes Kelly to acknowledge his wife at all. No focus on her, but more what Kelly was doing.
911, what is your emergency? Hello?
Yes, robbery.
You were just robbed?
Yes.
Okay, what happened?
That's his focus.
Somebody, I don't know, I just pulled it from inside the house.
Alibi?
Okay, was somebody there that held you at gunpoint, or were you burglarized?
I was not there.
You weren't there?
No.
Okay, so your house has been burglarized?
Yes.
Okay, are you on Tamarisk?
Yes, my wife.
At 39679?
I think my wife's been killed.
Finally.
What, sir?
I think my wife has been killed.
Okay, what are you seeing?
I think my wife has been killed also. In the burglary. She was home alone.
Okay, do you see her?
Yes.
And what's going on?
She's lying on the ground and there's blood underneath her.
Okay, is she breathing?
No.
Okay, so you just returned home to find your house burglarized and your wife is on the ground. And she's bleeding?
What?
She's bleeding?
Huh?
Is she bleeding?
Yes.
Okay, and not breathing?
Yes.
Is there anyone else in the house?
No, my sister is my in-laws next door.
Okay, what happened? You left to take the kids to school. What happened?
What's
it? What happened?
I left. My wife had the baby. I left to go get some coffee this morning.
You left your wife and baby what?
Get coffee and get some milk.
Okay.
For the baby.
Okay.
I kept coming. I drove in, I walked in the house, the baby was crying, I picked him up, went upstairs to look for my wife, and there she was, and the house has been everything torn up.
So right there, I'll stop with that, because that was overwhelming right there, but no focus on his wife, period, describes a burglary. He makes we call it minimizing statement, which establishes his alibi. I just got home, and somebody broke in my house.
Yeah, hey 911, I got robbed. Oh, by the way, my wife is shot and dead in the back room.
And
the
actual transcript, it took 2.5 pages to mention his wife. And innocent people tend to request help immediately, and the focus is the victim. Those who
innocent
are guilty.
Innocent people would have said, hey, my wife is dead.
That's why you call. No, well, that's why you call, to get help. But you don't call to say, well, here's what I think happened. Imagine yourself, as an innocent person. You come home, God forbid, you find your wife on the ground, and you look like someone broke in. You're be begging for help for your wife if you're innocent. Someone guilty, what? I talked about this last time. What motivates a guilty person to call? To mislead, period. So to do that, the focus is not your victim, but alibi and the events.
Hmm.
And these are simply initial evaluations.
How were you able to convict this dude?
Well, actually, it was built on circumstantial evidence. They found out absolutely, they ruled out any other possibility. This happened in a very nice condominium area. And then once they established that Kelly had racked up bills, was seeing prostitutes, the scene was actually staged. And that's almost always done by someone who's close to your victim, because Isabella had no defensive wounds at all. She didn't fight. Yet the whole scene looked like it was a fight. And that's what staging is, to make you think that what you see is something other than what it really is. And most of the time, those who are very close to your victims will stage that crime scene to throw you off. And that was a poorly staged crime scene. But, a lot of cases like that are, they're circumstantial. And most homicide investigations that don't go cold or do not go inactive are circumstantial cases, which means there's no direct evidence involved.
Was he talking so low on the phone call to confuse and the
I'm not
dispatcher?
Sure what he would go. Well, that's another good point, too. His emotions weren't there. He's very soft-spoken. He wasn't excited. You know, just know that the whole thing was to focus on what I was doing while somebody killed my wife. But he's not soft-spoken by, you know, by the normal. Because I've heard that guy up with an interview, and that's not what the way Kelly Jarka sounds.
Okay. Now we're going to switch it up a little bit because we're done with the 911 phone call killers for this episode.
Okay.
Now, I have a question for you. Me and my wife, we watch a lot of murder documentaries. Okay. Now, my question is, especially like when it comes to like a lot of Netflix shows always have, they always try to victimize the villain and villainize the cops, right, which I see through that liberal shit. But there are some times in which cops do make a mistake and do arrest the wrong person.
Sure.
And the main focus was because they had tunnel vision. How easy can a detective have or get into the tunnel vision, and how hard is it for them to back up and realize that and back out of that tunnel vision to look at the wider picture?
Very, very hard to do. And that's why when I train
detectives... Is that a good question?
It's a very good question.
Okay.
Because tunnel vision obviously kills police officers. You focus on one thing and not what's around you. Tunnel vision with homicide investigations kills homicide investigations. Because what happens, mainly at the crime scene, there's three things you cannot go back and do again. Process your scene, collecting evidence, documenting your crime scene, and collecting canvassing data. So the active phase of any homicide has a window that closes on you really, really fast. So during that time, you've got to be objective in your way of thinking and consider every possibility. So what happens with some detectives, and sometimes there's an ego that plays a little bit of a role, but they don't want to be wrong in their way of thinking. So they'll walk through a scene during the evaluation and they say, okay, here's what I think happened. And they focus on circumstances that support what they think happened, but block out things that don't support it. And that's called tunnel vision. So what happens if you enter the ongoing phase and things suddenly change and you're like, wow, this is not what I thought it was. And you go back and look at scene photographs. Oh man, I missed that. Well, then you're done. So that does happen. It's very hard to, because you're going to get criticized for it. And policemen know that. If you focus so much on one thing and arrest the wrong person and the case doesn't get solved, that yeah, it's hard to back yourself out of something like that. It really is. You can go back with any murder and reapproach it as far as a victim and evidence that was collected. But you can't go back and do your scene ever again. You get one chance to do that.
I would think, though, as a cop, if you have your morals right,
oh yeah,
I would say I would admit, you know what, I was wrong. He's guilty. Let's do what we can to find the guilty person and get this guy out of jail.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And typically, if you develop evidence in an investigation, whether you say charge someone or not, you might have a suspect on your radar, but not yet charge that person. And then you may have charged that person. But in the course of the ongoing investigation, you start to find either witnesses or evidence that is in favor of that defendant. That's called exculpatory evidence. So by disclosure and discovery motions by any defense attorney, and we've always practiced, I know in Norfolk and all the guys I work with there were always people of principle. The prosecutors were all phenomenal people and they would disclose everything. So we would never, not that it doesn't happen, but if we had any evidence that said, hey, this guy didn't do it, I'd say, here it is, guys. And we dip it right there in the bud and have enough, I guess, what do you call it? Not principle, but to say, okay, I have to start over and look at something else.
Okay, have you known anyone or even at yourself with your experiences, were you pressured by like the DA or anybody? Hey, find somebody.
Never by the DA. Maybe sometimes by a supervisor.
Like they wanted the case closed, they don't care who was arrested or what, you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, we had, I wouldn't say they wouldn't care who was arrested. I don't think you want to have that. If you have that mindset, you ain't going to be a cop.
Yeah, because you lots
know,
of times.
No matter what, charge someone.
Because
no.
When they are wrong, like yes. You know, sometimes they are, okay? Not all the time. It's very low percentage that they are. The cop or that damn DA guy will never admit that they're wrong. I'm like, come on, just say you made a mistake. Human error. And you don't want someone rotten in jail that's innocent.
Yes.
That's the one thing that hurts me.
I actually was asked that question in a webinar I did 2 weeks ago by a detective. And they said, what would you rather see? someone guilty walk free, like we believe Casey Anthony or O.J. Simpson, or somebody innocent go to prison. And that's a no-brainer. Somebody guilty walk free every time. And deprive somebody of their you know, freedom is a horrible thing to do. But that person who's guilty and walked away is going to screw up again because it's called karma.
Yeah.
But hopefully they don't go out and injure or kill someone, you know, for us to put them back behind bars. But everything that we do and focus on, and the reason why you want to properly manage your murder investigations is so that that does not happen. Because I've seen it happen before. It's obviously happened before because we see all the time someone served 25 years in prison. And the Innocent Project gets involved, and they either find new evidence by witnesses or DNA that exonerates that person, but they just gave up 3 decades of their life.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the worst thing that could ever happen. But I would say no, 99.999% of all police officers fight for justice and do the right thing. And many of them will admit, okay, you know what, man, I didn't mess up. But what I thought this was ended up being this now.
Mm-hmm.
And you changed directions. I can't think of the number of times in homicide investigations that we have changed directions on things. And like one year we had, if you recall, a state senator, Bill Robinson. Someone tried to kill him after Christmas in his parking lot at work. And the suspect, and we didn't have pressure to solve that, but a little bit, because it was a state senator. Someone tried to kill him downtown Norfolk. And the suspect became a sitting circuit court judge, Luther Edmonds. And Luther tried to kill Bill Robinson over political greed. And, you know, but we weren't really, I mean, we had a little bit of pressure, but not to charge anyone. Go find the real killer and put this asshole behind bars.
I
it's time to get pressure to solve it, but put the right person in.
Okay. Well, another episode down. It was an awesome episode. Appreciate you being a recurring guest.
Always. Merry Christmas to everybody.
Now, you and I had the same birthday.
Absolutely.
Did you do anything or you haven't? Did you do anything for your birthday?
I was actually working. Okay. I did a webinar. Then I went home, had dinner with the family, and made it a pretty easy night.
All right. Well, everybody out there that's listening, if you want to be a guest on my podcast, please contact me. I don't get paid for this. People think I do, but I don't. I'm not Joe Rogan. So. Yeah, anyway. And so I don't message prep. I'm not going to question prep you. You know, you want to be on, come on, I'll ask you questions. I'm not going to have you on because people ask that if I'm there, if I'm having lunch, so I could try to stump them. I said, why would I want to stump a guest?
No.
That defeats the purpose.
You ask very good questions.
Yeah, so I don't prep. Very good questions. You come on, I ask you questions.
Absolutely.
I don't have any, I don't get paid. And so just, I'd be more than help. I just like people coming on because I feel like people like learn a lot from this podcast.
Absolutely.
All this different wisdom that people come on to drop is awesome. And last but not least, my co-host, Sardini, my boy Sar, wants to wish everybody a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, which I believe is the main reason why I have guests, because they want to meet Sar.
They don't
give a shit about me. They want to meet Sar because he's
beautiful dog.
He's a good greeter at the door.
Yeah, he is. Intimidating.
Yeah, right.
Intimidating.
Yeah. Well, all right, guys. I hope you enjoyed the episode. And you can hear my sexy voice next Wednesday.